My name is Thaddeus Russell. For the past 20 years, I've taught history, politics, and philosophy at elite colleges and universities. I've written books challenging conventional academic ideas about American history and politics. I love teaching and research and writing, and I hate everything else about academia. I've found that colleges, which are supposed to be places where you're free to talk about ideas, are actually anti-intellectual. There's no real debate because almost everyone agrees on the big issues, and those who don't agree are often silenced. That's why I'm starting a new kind of college. It's called Renegade University. At Renegade University, you'll learn things about history I promise you've never heard before. In online lectures and seminars, and in face-to-face classes in cities across the country, you'll see the most sacred ideas challenged fiercely. And you'll be encouraged to do something that most college students aren't allowed to do. Think differently. Renegade University will offer courses on the history of the United States, the history of American foreign policy, and the history of political ideas, all taught from radically different perspectives. There will also be courses devoted entirely to having the smartest people from different schools of thought debate each other directly. You won't see that in a college classroom. If you want to learn entirely new ways of thinking about history and have your ideas challenged and sharpened and be treated like a free thinker, I think you should join the revolution and become a part of Renegade University.
Everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to the show. Today is March 8th. Ooh, 100 years ago today, the Russian Revolution began, and I was trying to think of like a fun joke for you, but geez, the results are still not funny. That reminds me of this song, the bumper music you're hearing. It's called School on Fire by Greta. We have to point out today that that's metaphorical. We don't advocate the actual burning of things here. And that provides us a suitable transition to today's guest, Berkeley, California native Thaddeus Russell, a fan favorite, certainly one of my favorite guests as well. Thad and I first encountered each other 4 years ago at the New Hampshire Liberty Forums when we first sat down for an interview. I hadn't read his book yet. I didn't really know what I was getting into with Thad. I just knew I had a few friends who were fans of his book, and they also liked his style. I did too. So after we did an interview for like a half an hour, I went and I read Renegade and I said, this should be a whole podcast series. And then it was. The point that I'm trying to make is go to schoolsucksproject.com, search for Thaddeus Russell. He's been one of our most regular guests over the last 4 years. But of all the conversations we've had, I think this one today was my favorite. The show took many unexpected twists and turns. I will tell you that when we started, I had 27 post-its stuck to my desk. During the hour and 45-minute conversation we had, I peeled away just three of them, which is totally fine because this is actually the beginning of a little mini-series, a three-parter on the problem of academic conformism and the social and political problems that conformism helps to create. So that video that I played at the beginning of the show today is the promotion for Renegade University. We've been talking about this on School Sucks since it was just an idea, but now it is happening. The registration for Renegade University's first offering opened earlier this week. It is an in-person seminar, Renegade History of the United States with Thaddeus Russell. It's being held in Los Angeles from May 4th to May 25th. And you can learn more about it at ThaddeusRussell.com. We're going to be talking about Renegade University in some detail in the third installment of this little series. The first two episodes focus on problems, and there's no shortage of those. And one of the things that I hope to work into the second episode is some of your questions and your responses to what you hear in the show today. So please feel free to share them in the School Sucks Facebook group. I'll collect them. And when we record our part two, I'll try to work some of that stuff into the conversation. So the big news right now is the in-person seminar happening in May. But before we wrap up this series, Thad and I will discuss the online version of the university and some other in-person events. More are coming. So congratulations to Thad. He's done it. He's found a path out of academia. And if you ask me, his timing is impeccable. It is not a good scene in higher education right now. And too many of these colleges are becoming very unsafe places when it comes to the introduction and debate of even mildly controversial ideas. You're going to learn a lot more about that in the show today. So please go to ThaddeusRussell.com, jump on his mailing list to get updates about Renegade University, and please watch and share that promotional video. It is embedded in the show notes. All right, everybody, thanks for listening. Here we go.
And he lifted up his hands and reached to the sky, let out a yell and no one replied. Frustration and torment tore him inside. Then he fell to the ground and he cried and he cried.
Thad.
Hey, Brett.
We are going to focus in a little bit of a mini-series here on the current state of higher education, and we're going to try and narrow our focus to intellectual conformity, the problem of intellectual conformity among academics. Mm-hmm. And this is something that we've talked about on the show in the past, but, you know, every 6 months goes by now, and it's basically a new world. And there's plenty of news from higher education. So I want to just bring people up to date. And, you know, this is a problem that I've been wrestling with on the show for like over a year now, trying to have a comprehensive understanding of the higher education landscape. And it's obviously a very multifaceted problem. But I want to see where we can get by, you know, addressing this question of intellectual conformity among the academics. Who, if anyone, is responsible for this? Where and when did this begin? Why does this problem exist? And ultimately, what can be done about it? So your experience, people in the audience know it well. But where did you first start to observe this problem of conformity? And how has it changed since your initial observations?
My first week in college.
When I was, right.
I mean, I'm serious. Yeah. I mean, and that's when I was of them, you know, that's when I was a good leftist, and I was at a very, very left-wing college, Antioch College, which I think I've talked about on here before.
Right.
And I remained pretty hardcore left socialist through all the way through college. I never wavered from that. But, from the very beginning though, I was uncomfortable with what I saw as, not just intellectual and political conformism, but, a readiness to morally to punish those who wavered from the line. That's a left-wing, good old left-wing term, the line. There's mm-hmm. a line. Every political organization should have a line, and you're supposed to follow it.
Right.
And it comes from Leninism. That's the Leninist idea of party discipline. The party must maintain, Lenin said, you know, internal discipline, which meant an intellectual discipline. The party establishes a particular position on a political question, and once that happens, it's democratic until then, but then once, it's called democratic centralism in Leninism, then once the party takes that position on a political question, everyone in the party must obey that position, must follow that position, and carry it out without any deviation whatsoever. And anyone who does is called a deviationist or a splitter and is expelled. So my parents were in a Leninist organization in the 1960s and 70s in Berkeley when I was a kid, when I was growing up. And that's what happened. And in fact, my mother both expelled friends of hers who were comrades, that's what they called each other.
Yep.
And she herself was expelled for deviationism. So that idea Leninism, in Leninism, this democratic centralist idea. I would call it democratic authoritarianism, and I don't think that's an oxymoron, because I think democracy, of course, is authoritarian, and we can talk about that too.
Sure, yeah.
But I think the roots of that idea are from Christianity, that Christian denominations, particular Christian churches, not all, but generally speaking, over the last 2,000 years or so, have essentially taken that same sort of, essentially structured their thinking and have organized their people and have maintained internal discipline in very similar ways, so that you have a whole bunch of debate about the text, interpretations of the text, which they call hermeneutics, or scholars call hermeneutics. What did Jesus actually say? What does this actually mean? But then once the wise men or women decide what the Bible actually says, we must, as a denomination, adhere to that particular interpretation with no deviation whatsoever. Then, inevitably, of course, someone reads the text a little differently and has a different idea about what Jesus said, and then they are either thrown out or they establish their own rival denomination, and hence we have an infinite number of Christian churches and denominations around the world. But so I think, you know, what's the origin of intellectual conformism on campuses today? Yeah, it's the Bible. It's actually the history. I mean, not the Bible. It's not the Bible's fault. It's a book. It's Christianity. It's this idea that there is a good and an evil. There is a God and a son of God who are good, and there is evil. There is Satan. And we must adhere as closely as possible to the good. And if we deviate from the good in any significant degree, we are in danger of becoming completely evil or of serving the interests of the devil. I do think that's really it. We call that Manichaeanism, which is, you know, this belief in, you know, black and white and evil. The world is divided between the two. There's nothing in between. There's no gray area.
Right.
It's an unnuanced view of the world. Is almost deliberately unnuanced, and that I actually almost want to cry saying this, but I do think that is most, I think that is a dominant way of thinking in the modern academy, and I don't mean among students, I mean among professors.
Sure.
Boy, it's really depressing even saying that. Even though I've been saying this for years and years and years, it just really hits me. And because it's become so clear in the last, 3 months, 4 months, mm-hmm. since the Trump thing, when it just, all these patterns that we've seen for years in the academy just got cranked up to the nth degree, and people are now literally physically attacking those who might be fascists, even though they're not at all fascists. They're just Republicans, or they're just voted for Trump. But it's really, and I don't even mean, you know, forget about the Milo thing at Berkeley, which was incredible enough. But I mean, you know, they're just now at Middlebury, that professor, do you know about this? That professor was physically attacked there.
Who was there with Charles Murray?
For hosting Charles Murray.
Yeah.
For bringing him to the campus. She was, as the story goes, I kind of doubt she's lying about it, but. And is in a neck brace, was someone grabbed her hair and yanked her neck because she had brought Charles Murray. Because Charles Murray, of course, wrote The Bell Curve 30 years ago and
sure.
has a chapter in it, which, you know, I haven't read it. Apparently links race to IQ, et cetera. So,
yeah,
which I haven't read it, so I'm not going to comment. But if it's true that he does that it is technically racist. You know, I mean, he may be right. I don't think he's right, but it doesn't matter. The point is that he could be utterly wrong. I bet that he is wrong. I bet that I would have a whole host of criticisms. Now, the thing is, I wouldn't have any moral criticisms of him
right.
on that ground at all. I would just want to know if he's right.
I'll say this, and I think this is an interesting insert here. Murray's book that he wrote with an old Harvard professor who used to get hell from Students for a Democratic Society in the early 70s. His name escapes me right now. It seems like the book has a lot of opportunities for confirmation bias. Like if you're reading this book, The Bell Curve, and you're white, congratulations, you are part of the intellectual elite. You are part of the the IQ elite. But there's so many criticisms of the book available online, and it's not a difficult read. It's not a scientific book. It's kind of a pop psychology, pop science book. And there are so many great opportunities for debate. They actually had one of these debates. I forget the Canadian – two Canadian professors debated this in like the mid-90s, this very subject. Why wouldn't that be the route? You know, I mean, I know this is a slow pitch softball question I'm asking you here, but why wouldn't that be the route to engage with these people? I mean, I remember talking to you on the show before about this idea that discourse is a form of violence, kind of extending this post-structural idea into the 21st century. And that was just very abstract to me until I actually now, over the last 2 years, have observed it in practice. So why is that preferable to the kind of discourse that people like you or people like Jordan Peterson have been calling for years?
Mm-hmm. Jordan Peterson. Yeah, we need to talk about him.
Sure.
Yeah, because people have been linking me with him. And apparently, I haven't listened to it. Apparently, Joe Rogan talked at length about me when he was interviewing Jordan Peterson. But
he did, yeah.
So let's see. Where were we? Why wouldn't they treat Murray's book as an intellectual problem rather than a moral crisis?
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. It's funny. I was watching Tucker Carlson, who's, you know, he's not exactly my cup of tea politically, but my goodness, everyone should watch him.
He's awesome.
Everyone. Yeah. Everyone should watch him right now. So, I mean, many, you know, I'd say about a third of the time, I think I completely disagree with him, and he's clearly more conservative than I am. But my God, the thing is, he does what I want to do and what academics should be forced to do. And he actually somehow manages to get some professors on his show, which shocks me, but I want to see more of that. And recently, just a couple of days ago, I think, he had a professor from Princeton University to talk about the Charles Murray incident. She's an anthropologist. She's African American, and her work is, I think, mostly on race. And I don't know much about her work at all, but she, Tucker said, you know, well, because she had led a big protest of Murray at Princeton recently that was similar. It wasn't violent, but, you know, they got up and basically walked out and did a big thing. And she was essentially defending the students at Middlebury for doing what they did to Murray. And Tucker said, well, I mean, have you read the book? Yeah. And she said, well, I've read pieces of it. I've read a lot of critiques of it. She clearly had not read the book. I mean, she may have read like little excerpts or something, but then she proceeded for the rest of the interview, and everyone should go look at this, you know, the rest of the interview was basically her saying, we have better things to do than take seriously bad scholarship, but she had not read it. So haven't I told you that I think the university is the last monastery?
Yeah,
that's what it is.
But it just seems like a more sophisticated version of the trick that every left winger that I've tried to have a conversation with uses to end the conversation, which is like, I can no longer continue to dignify you with my time or my responses. And it's just like, I look out at the world today and we clearly live in Donald Trump's world, and we see the emboldening a lot of these far right movements. And, you know, I wrestle with trying to understand how this happens. And I'm watching just, you know, in higher education over the last few years, and I think this extends to the online environment as well, you see this increasing fragility with the left, especially in higher education. And I don't want to go after the low-hanging fruit of like safe spaces and trigger warnings, but that stuff's a problem. And that culture creates weak people who, you know, basically – I've heard you tell the story about John McWhorter, right, and how he was in school in the 80s, and he's black. And people would say to him something racist, and you'd go, oh, well, that's too bad that person is a fool. But today it's like there's these theatrics surrounding even, you know, less offensive types of interactions. Like, I'm internally damaged. I'm traumatized by words. And you have this.
All right.
So on the left, you have this fragility. But on the right, you have this other thing that you've talked about, which is repression. People have to retreat into anonymous chat rooms, and in that repressed state, they get angry. So now you have the angry and the energetic right versus the fragile and ready to burst into tears left. You know,
well,
and it's setting up a bad scene.
Okay, but let's calm down for a second.
Yeah, no problem.
which is that everything you said, everything you described is going on. That's what I think that's all true. I think that's all going on. It is also going on both sides among less than 5% of the population.
I agree.
Right. This is basically theater that's being performed by a very small portion of the population for each other.
Yeah, that's true.
They're not. So when I walk around, you know, in Los Angeles or in Portland, Oregon, where I've been spending a lot of time lately, you know, I don't hear people talking about this stuff almost ever. Even
I agree.
Portland and Los Angeles, which are, you know, pretty very highly educated, pretty left-wing cities, right? Even there, rarely do I heard once in Portland, I was in a restaurant recently, so I heard some woman talking about Trump. But that's it. So you said something about the emboldening right-wing movements. I see no evidence for that. I see none. I don't think there's anything going on at all, actually. I don't think the hysteria about Trump has so far been proven to be just that. There is nothing going on that is not totally ordinary Republican politics. And in fact, in some ways, it's a softer Republicanism than mainstream people in the past. You know, I mean, even the travel ban is it's a repurposed version of, you know, many similar bans in the past. This is nothing new at all. And not to mention the 50 years when the United States banned basically all immigration from most of the world. But the so-called alt-right, I mean, we know this, right? Your listeners know this. It's a handful of dudes on the internet with zero institutional or political or cultural power.
Oh, yeah, and I'm not that arguing that they have any either,
okay.
Just to be clear.
They got nothing going on. The thing about the, you know, attacks on or the threats on Jewish institutions and synagogues and schools, et cetera. I mean, I think that was just shown to be basically a few people doing robocalls from overseas, right? And one guy who was trying to frame his girlfriend for it, you know, it's nothing. And I was pretty sure it was nothing when I heard about it. The Southern Poverty Law Center, you know, statistics about the rise in hate crimes that they keep trotting out, it's all nonsense. You know, the vast majority of it is a kid at a school putting something on a chalkboard. There's almost zero violence, physical. So here's the thing.
Sure.
If you look at the physical violence against people since Trump's election or since Trump even, you know, since even the primary, there's almost none going from right to left, as far as I know, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And there's, I'm not going to say it's been like a pogrom or anything, but there's been significant violence from left to right.
Absolutely.
I mean, no doubt about it. I mean, look at the video. I mean, it's all kinds of video evidence. We have video evidence of that. So anyway, but it's still, you know, when I watched the Berkeley thing, cause that's my hometown. And, you know, I had to.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Yep.
Watching it and mocking it online. It was a mutual performance, I think. And forget even Milo. It was just, it was the Trump people coming in, no doubt from the suburbs, because none of them, I'm sure, live in Berkeley, to flaunt themselves in front of the crazy lefties in Berkeley. And then it was the Berkeley crazy lefties doing the extreme performance of virtue signaling, which is what it is. And so what they've done is they've taken virtue signaling to its ultimate conclusion, you know, which is you got to put your body on the line. Of course, they're not, because Berkeley police never touch you. So where were we?
Well, I just want to point of clarification. What started your response to me, I think the language I used was emboldening a movement. And I think that paints a picture, especially when we look at emboldened movements historically, right? That creates some pretty powerful imagery. What I mean by that is in the last 2 years, as far as like right-wing ethno-statism or nationalism, as far as those things are concerned, a few years ago, you would have a YouTube commenter whose name was JewHater3412. Now you have Richard Spencer, who is a man using his real name with his real face, going out and making statements and creating a conference. Like it doesn't seem like there was a space for that before the actions of the left created that to be so open and out in front of everybody. That's what I mean by emboldening.
Oh, okay. So yeah, you were surprising me and confusing me, but maybe I'm not surprised or confused anymore. Okay, so Richard Spencer is a non-phenomenon if the media didn't pay attention to him.
Absolutely.
Because of the Trump thing. He, you know, his conference, his notorious conference of Nazis on the Capitol, on Capitol Hill, that was, you know, about to march on Washington and establish a dictatorship, was how many people? And about half of them were media. You know, it was like 20 or 50 people or whatever, and half of them were media.
Right.
His, I just checked his Twitter. I'm one of his Twitter followers. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
He, I think he has 40,000 Twitter followers, 50,000. How many of those do you think are media people or people like me who just want to see what this knucklehead has to say?
Or how many people who want to write articles based on anything he does and then referring to him in the article 15 times as Trump supporter, Richard Spencer, yeah. Trump supporter, Trump supporter, Trump supporter. Yeah.
What's the guy's name? The great blogger, Scott Codex, something, Star Codex?
Star Slate Codex is the
Star
site.
Star Slate Codex, yeah. So he did the great job of breaking down exactly how big the alt-right is, how many white nationalists there really are, how many actual white supremacist racists there actually are in this country right now. And it was not news to me. I've always known this. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the things I've always just despised about the left, and they're still doing it. They're doing it more than ever, of course, which is to pretend that the Ku Klux Klan is meaningful in any way in this country. You know, the Ku Klux Klan hasn't killed anybody in decades. They have absolutely zero political power, no institutional. They are the most shunned organization in American history. I mean, they are nobody, 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 and have done nothing at all to anyone. The SPLC is, I think, one of the most toxic organizations in the country. And they've been doing this racket for years and years and years. And I was onto them early on, even when I was a lefty back in the 80s, watching Morris Dees do his thing. That's when he started getting going. And I think I saw him talk somewhere. And I knew the guy was a huckster, just basically just selling white guilt.
Right.
Yeah, it's just a microscopic portion of the population. Oh, and then the funniest part, because I think Spencer's sort of interesting. You know, I wanted to know, like, how is he actually riffing on fascism? You know, is he actually, because I've been writing about German Nazism a lot. And so I've studied the hell out of it for the last 2 years, and I've written an 80-page chapter on it. And, so I was just curious if he, once I finally found out what Hitler was actually about, I wanted to find out how closely Spencer hewed to that line, and he doesn't at all. I don't know if you know about Spencer's politics.
I've watched a few of his speeches and I've heard a few of his interviews, and I think he's far more innocuous. If you hear him, Dave Smith filled in for Gavin McInnes and interviewed him on that show. He said the number one guy I want to talk to is Spencer, and then his number two guy was Cantwell. So the two great, interesting, very sober and calm conversations. And I just said, gosh, I wish there would be more of these discussions. I know why Jeffrey Tucker had to kind of, do that performance at the Students for Liberty conference. I said in an earlier show, I know he wants to be a good steward of that, and he doesn't want Spencer and ethno-nationalists mix up with that. So he was right to kick him out for the sake of the event. But I would like to hear more of these interactions and these discussions and debates.
I knew that Spencer showed up to that conference. I didn't know what Jeffrey did, but I knew that I saw that it was a big thing at the conference. No, but so here's the thing about Spencer. He is calling for whites to establish a separate ethno state, right?
Mm-hmm.
To secede, essentially, or, you know, just to have their homeland. I think he calls it that, a white homeland or a Nordic homeland or something. Meaning he wants to take all the whites and leave.
Well, leave. I don't think he wants to leave the United States.
What's that?
I don't think he wants to leave the United States. I think he wants to be able to do that in the United States.
Well, no, but he wants a separate, as I understand, a separate nation state. Either, I mean, he hasn't specified where physically it would be, but it would be separate from the United States, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
It's a separate white ethno nation state, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's clearly racist. He's obviously a racist. You know, he's so the other funny thing about him, though, is he thinks Asians are biologically superior to whites, too.
Oh, this is IQ data. Yeah.
This guy is the softest fascist there's ever been. So I watched him. I don't know why we're talking about this. We shouldn't be talking about it, but whatever. I saw him give this incredibly entertaining interview with Roland McMartin, who's he's just a pundit, mm-hmm. not a very smart pundit, been around for a long, long time, who, you know, he was just, he had to take on Richard Spencer, because this was the issue of the day, and I'm going to show this man, I'm going to show how stupid he is, and I'm Roland Martin. Spencer was like, what's the problem? Like, we just want to go. we just want to leave. Why? And then Martin was outraged that Spencer was not a loyal American. That's what it came down to. He was furious that Spencer was not a loyal American and didn't believe the blacks built the pyramids. If he wants to take all the racists and go somewhere else, why is that a problem? In fact, isn't that the greatest gift if you're a black person in the United States?
Well,
I mean, you should like him more than anybody else. He wants to take all the racists away.
You know, that's an interesting perspective. And you just said we shouldn't be talking about this. Like, based on our outline, we shouldn't be talking about this. But I know why we are. You haven't started your podcast yet, so you...
It is important, actually.
Yeah, so you probably need an outlet for stuff like this, but it's actually, like, the perfect lead-in to really, like, the first or second question that I wanted to ask you. We first encountered each other around this time 4 years ago, and you came to New Hampshire to give a speech. We've talked regularly on my show since then, 2 years after that in 2015. We were still having conversations where we were basically staking out the same position. You know, like the same position that we initially encountered each other with in 2013.
Yeah.
You know, the same was true until very recently. But I follow you on Twitter and I see what you post on Facebook. And I've noticed that there seems to be, and this is like a big, exciting topic for, I think, a lot of people in my audience who've followed you for a while. It seems like your thinking has changed a little bit, not just since 2013, but really in the last couple of years. And as we work our way back to talking about the problem of intellectual conformity in academia, why don't you just talk about that for a couple minutes? Because I've even seen, you know, tweets that you put out where I said, is this defending Donald Trump? You know, that kind of, which is more attacking the media, I know. But yeah, just talk about what you've been experienced over the last couple of years and the effect it's had.
Well, the thing about Trump, which is what most people have noticed, you know, my reaction to this phenomenon, I'm pretty sure I would have had exactly the same reaction, you know, five years ago. My thinking on that hasn't changed at all, which is just that the left is not just a bunch of fucking hypocrites, but they are murderous hypocrites, meaning that they not only condone but support mass murder when it's their guy doing it, and then pretend to be outraged when it's the guy who doesn't speak proper English and use proper etiquette doing
it. Right.
And in fact, by the way, so far, as I understand it, haven't seen definitive numbers yet, but the number of deportations under Trump has declined compared to Obama. Obama was deporting, and this was in his last year when he had scaled it down. This was in one of the lower years. He was deporting more than 1,000 people a month.
Yeah, there's some real, just to jump in on that, there's some real media literacy problems, even inside the circle of people who are calling themselves libertarians. And I see this stuff on Facebook. So about a month ago, somebody that I'm friends with posted this story from these immigration detention centers, right? And they said, they said in this post, this is what's happening right now. And the article, I don't remember the news source, but I looked over like their trending articles and their recent posts just to get a sense of their political vantage point that they're coming from. And the first paragraph of the article is something like, Donald Trump is doing these things with immigration. Here's some pictures of immigration detention centers. So acting like this is a current event. So I wound up doing a Google image search on the images, these terrible images, like really heartbreaking images that you see of these people in detention centers. They're all from a Huffington Post article that was published in 2014. So there's a lot of unnecessary hysteria, and it's too much for anybody to go through like item by item and carefully process. Like, it's a think fast world. Things are coming at people too fast. To get knowledge and to get like confidence in a subject area, you need to go vertically into it, as I'm sure you know from studying a particular discipline. But what people are getting right now, just through the media, whether it's social or it's the mainstream media, is this vast horizontal view of the world. And they're not getting any depth into any topic. So the result is just overwhelm. People are interfacing with current events through headlines and through images and through tweets and retweets. I'd put some of the responsibility on the schools and the universities for not teaching this kind of, you know, intellectual self-defense and media literacy. But that is a huge fanning of the flames.
Oh, boy. Too much to unpack, man. We got to do this more often.
Yeah.
Be careful there with blaming the schools for not teaching media literacy, because in my home state of California, there are two bills in the legislature right now Are you aware of this?
No.
That will train our students, and I mean, I believe it's junior high and high school students, to be able to ascertain what is fake news.
Oh, yeah. Maybe they could just give them a list of like fake news sites, Drudge Report, InfoWars. You know, I wonder if it will be more complicated than that.
Guess which party is promoting those bills. But anyway.
Democrat, yeah.
So quickly, quick aside, if you're an immigration activist, if you're an ACLU lawyer working in immigration, or if you're one of us, one of the, you know, 15 people in this country who cared about immigration before last year and therefore paid attention to it, you would know that in 2014, when you were talking about, mm-hmm. was the Obama administration ramped up the deportation and incarceration of women and children from Central America.
Yep.
Yeah. And we're talking about, I can't find exact numbers, but we're talking about tens of thousands of people, women
yeah,
and children. Yeah. And they put them first into detention centers and then they send them back to El Salvador.
Mm-hmm.
So I get called when I say this, you know, and I lost some fans. I was mm-hmm. telling you before we went on the air, you know, it's some left libertarians who were my first fans, I think, and the first libertarians I knew. I didn't know anything about libertarians at all until they came along, called me a collaborationist with Trump. And then the dumber ones would say things, you know, about his penis and my mouth.
Sure.
And the relationship between the two, the somewhat more intelligent ones said that I was actually collaborating with Trump by pointing out that it would be a good idea to, if you're actually interested in ending deportations, to pay attention to what's happening, no matter who the president is, because the president we just had was arguably was by far the worst president in terms of his treatment of people trying to cross a border since the racist 1924 National Origins Act was overturned in 1965. So basically that's my lifetime. I was born in 1965. So he was clearly the, and no one disagrees, who knows anything about this.
Yeah.
Obama's clearly the worst in terms of turning around, and we're talking about not criminals in many cases. Many of them, of course, were criminals, but we're talking about women and children and many people whose only crime was to cross a border. He was by far the worst president since 1965. And so to suddenly say that doing that is the height of racism and possibly fascistic, and that pointing out what Obama did is to collaborate with a racist and a fascist.
Almost like an apology. See, that's really bizarre to me. I mean, I would think that most left libertarians wouldn't feel that much differently about Obama. And when you gave them this information or even said, hey, look into this for yourself, and they did, they'd come back and say, oh, I didn't know that. I'm a little calmer now, but that's also awful. I mean, that was similar to the response that I got when I said, hey, these pictures that you're posting trying to scare people with this immigration detention center story, those were from when Obama was president. I think the response was something like, yeah, but I was against it then too. Versus Democrats, like straight Democrats who would just say, let's not dredge up the past. You know, that might be their response to that. But I'm surprised you're getting that kind of pushback from left libertarians.
So sure, I get it. If I were saying what Trump is doing is just fine and dandy,
right?
You would have a point. I have never supported that piece of shit for one second. And certainly not his immigration policies at all. I was somewhat optimistic about some of his foreign policy ideas, mostly regarding Europe. Mm. I always have said publicly on the Middle East, he's at least as bad as everyone before him and possibly worse.
Mm-hmm.
And he also scares the shit out of me because he clearly is somewhat erratic. Although I think that being erratic in the way he is quite possibly less dangerous than Hillary Clinton's very deliberate, very well thought out, very coherent policy of mass murder.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's see. We got sidetracked again.
Yeah, no, this is totally fine that this happens. We're working from a very loose outline. You want to talk about these things. People in my audience want to hear you talk about these things. So this is all fine. But we're talking about some changes in your thinking. And what we got so far was like the interactions with left libertarians, the people who were warm to you initially and maybe even a bridge into the libertarian world. That bridge, in many respects, burned.
Well, I don't know. That's up to them. Yeah. I didn't burn anything. But, yeah. I don't know. Maybe they're warming up to me now that I've started saying nasty things about Trump, too. But what was the point of saying nasty things about Trump when everybody in my whole world, the entire media, and I mean the entire media, including Fox News, 110% of academia, 100% of the political establishment, Republicans and Democrats, except for Jeff Sessions, I mean, everyone in the whole wide world who had a name, who had a platform of any kind, right, who wasn't an anonymous person in the Midwest somewhere, every single person was violently denouncing Trump all day, every day for a year and a half.
Right.
What exactly would I contribute? Whose mind would I change by joining in and saying that Trump is a racist and a fascist? And by the way, I'll say this for the 100th time. I have never seen any evidence that at least his political ideas, his policy ideas are racist or fascist. There are certainly some similarities, and we can certainly talk about this, between some of Trump's rhetoric, some of Trump's style, people have talked about this, and some of Mussolini's style and rhetoric.
Sure.
Sure. Beyond that, I'm searching my mind. I don't think there's anything. When he first proposed his infrastructure program way back in like last summer, I think, I said, oh shit, he may actually be more fascist than I thought, because guess what? Massive infrastructure public works programs were the centerpiece of the economic systems of where?
Germany and Italy.
Your listeners know Germany, Italy, and the United States.
Right. Yeah, oh, yeah, that's shouldn't forget that.
People who know my book know that.
Yeah, right.
But then it turns out that it's hardly fascist at all, because it's cronyism for sure. I'm not a fan of it. It's a quite highly privatized system he's talking about, which fascists don't like that. They like to have total control. Hello, ding dong. Right. Fascism is a system of complete state control. To allow businesses to basically manage these projects, you know, is not working. Then, of course, the biggest argument, biggest evidence against the claim that he's a fascist is his cabinet.
Yeah.
In particular on domestic stuff. So I've had these, I don't know, I'm unleashing, because like, you're right, I haven't started my own podcast. And by the way, I will soon. I actually have 3 interviews in the can, ready to go for that.
Yeah, awesome.
Took me a month to come up with a good title. I think I'm just gonna go with a really basic title. But when I have that podcast, I will then have a place to vent. Fascists were not interested in school choice, were they?
Absolutely not. No. Yeah, it seems like problems created by imprecision in language. And what I've noticed over the last couple of years, especially coming from the left and the media, is that it doesn't matter what words mean or what words are supposed to mean. We can change definitions and connotations as we see fit. So look what's happened with the whole punch a Nazi phenomenon. Look who's a Nazi now.
Hold on, Brett. Yeah. Not quite that stupid. They do act, because I've had these arguments with people where I said this, and they were like, they actually have an argument for this. No, DeVos is a fascist because she's interested. What she wants is a Christian theocracy, which, again, we can talk about the relationship between fascism and Christianity and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But okay, fine. I'm okay with calling a theocracy fascist, sure, but that's really what it's about. So she wants to privatize the schools and then hand them over to the Christian churches to run so that have you seen any evidence of this? I mean, I know she's Christian. I know she's given money to certain organizations, et cetera, et cetera. When she actually proposes or even suggests or even implies that Christian organizations will get preference in the charter school system or in any privatization scheme, yeah, we can talk about it. Well, but I have seen.
You're missing their point, though. Anyway. They're trying to get the drop on all these fascists, Thad, right? Because the whole hysteria, I thought it was really summed up well by Jim Jeffries' performance on Real Time with Bill Maher. I don't know if you saw clips of that, where Piers Morgan said something mildly in defense of Donald Trump. And Jim Jeffries, the comedian, you know, who's a leftist, you know, those are the serious people who think like him. He starts screaming, fuck you at Piers Morgan and flipping him off because Piers Morgan said it's not really like a Muslim ban. I don't think that's the most accurate description. And you could agree with that or not, but I don't agree with Jim Jeffries' response. And then Jim Jeffries, the only sentence he can put together is basically like, we need to be flipping out now because if people flipped out at Hitler on day one, none of that stuff would have happened. So every flip out is completely justified because of what it potentially heads off. That's the pattern I'm picking up.
Yeah, man, I'm telling you, it's Christianity. It's this belief in evil. It's a belief in evil. Evil is absolute. You can't negotiate with evil. You can't bargain with evil. If you change all of the material conditions around evil, it will still be evil. The only thing you can do with evil is remove it from the earth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So again, that's a Christian idea. That's a Christian idea. If you take something from evil, from Satan, from the devil, that might in itself, on its own, be useful or even good in a way, of course, because it comes from the devil, it is tainted. And if you eat it, the fruit, you become evil yourself. I don't see any other way to explain how these people think. And what's crushingly depressing to me is not so much that Australian left-wing comedians think that way, but that professors teaching social science,
and law
in the most prestigious universities in the world. Think. Here's another one. Here's a good one. So academic intellectual conformity. Okay. Back to this.
Yeah.
This pulls it all together. Okay. Academic conformism, Manichaean thinking in the academy, and changes in my thinking in the last 3 or 4 years. Okay.
Yep.
All rolled into one.
Nice.
All right. Man, it's been a rough 4 months, hasn't it? I mean, I don't know. For me, it's really, a lot of us are, my friends, the handful of people who think more or less like me on this stuff, we're kind of shell-shocked. I mean, we just been sort of like, especially those first few weeks, it was just, you know, get in the trench and just wait for the bombs to stop dropping. Because that's...
Since the election?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, since the election. Social media is almost no fun at all anymore. It's been tough on my mental health.
Yeah.
To have, and I've heard a few people talk about this, like it's we, the few, the proud, the brave. It's, you know, we've always felt isolated and it's always been a problem for me. And I, you know, I'm more isolated than most of you guys and libertarians, since I, as you well know, I have deviations from the libertarian line. So I've always been a loner. In that way, politically and intellectually. But now, holy God, it's been rough. And not just that I feel even more isolated, but that there's more danger than ever. And I mean, now it's actually physical. I'm not terribly worried about getting punched in the face, but I don't know. I think it's getting possible for that to happen now that they're actually attacking professors physically. But anyway, it's the emotional abuse. It's the emotional toll of being told. That's the thing. It's being forced because you're principled to not toe the line and not say hysterical things that are inaccurate and that cause us to lose sight of what's really, truly bad and damaging and murderous about Trump's policies. And by the way, that's the real problem for me. That's the real problem, more than the hypocrisy, about screaming about Trump being a fascist and a racist. If we spend all our time talking about that he's a fascist and a racist and that he's Putin's bitch, and also, by the way, I've seen a whole lot of really sexist language, actually, and actually technically homophobic language about that, because, you know, Trump is Putin's bitch and his whore and Mrs. Putin, and, you know, stuff that, like, is not okay to say.
They fuck, and it's funny. It's funny that they fuck and perform oral sex on each other because they're dudes.
Exactly,
yeah.
Because it's, you know, because no one, because that's a terrible thing for men to do. I mean, you hear left-wingers.
Absolutely.
It's homophobic jokes all the time. Okay, so wrapping all these things together, these strands together, they're Intelligence Squared US, you know about that, right?
Just for the people who don't, give us a quick overview.
Intelligence Squared US is a public broadcasting show. Started it in the UK, I think, on BBC. You know, it's an NPR kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's a regular, it's like monthly debate show style. The format is the Oxford style of debate. So it's two teams and it's competitive and the audience votes on who wins and who loses, et cetera. And a couple months ago, they had a debate about whether policing is racist. And one side arguing that it is racist was a black academic. I hate to do this, but she identifies herself this way, so I wouldn't identify her that otherwise, who is a tenured professor at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City, which is the preeminent school that studies, that researches criminal justice issues in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And a retired cop in New York. And the other side was Heather McDonald of the Manhattan Institute, who many of your listeners will probably know as kind of the leading conservative critic of Black Lives Matter and what she calls the war on cops, et cetera. And
right.
I don't agree with Heather McDonald on a lot of stuff, but she certainly takes down a whole lot of arguments that are made very loosely on the Black Lives Matter side. I'm still generally sympathetic to Black Lives Matter. I think they have gone very much off the rails, and my attitude toward them has changed significantly in the last 3 years.
Yeah.
My attitude about criminal justice and police violence and mass incarceration has changed quite significantly, actually,
in what ways?
In the last 2 or 3 years. So I forget her name, but the professor from John Jay said, and I'm not kidding you, this is just a couple months ago, she said that the black crime rates are only higher than white crime rates only because there is more policing done in black communities. Now, there is certainly a point to be made there, which is true, that black neighborhoods tend to be much more highly policed, right, than white neighborhoods. The question then is why? She said, and this is when it became science fiction, she said, if the policing were the same, the amount of policing were the same on the Upper East Side of Manhattan as it is in Brownsville, New York, which is the most violent neighborhood in New York City, Brownsville, Brooklyn, the crime rates would be identical.
Yeah.
So the crime rate in the neighborhood around the Metropolitan Museum of Art, Fifth Park Avenue, Madison, is the same, according to her, is truly, there's just as much crime happening in that neighborhood as there is in Brownsville, Brooklyn, or the South Side of Chicago, or Compton. And the other side said, you know, we're pretty sure that 100% of murders are reported, that there are no unknown murders going on anywhere, and certainly not on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. So they said to her, are you actually claiming that the murder rate is the same on the Upper East Side as it is in Brownsville? And for, I'm telling you, good 45 minutes to an hour, she essentially said yes.
Wow.
She couldn't, and this, I'm telling you, this is a tenured tenured professor, published professor at the preeminent school of criminal justice.
Interesting.
So what do you do with that? Now,
I don't know. It's like I see this all the time on Facebook, sometimes from like left-leaning libertarians, usually from people who aren't libertarians. It's like, fuck the people that I claim to want to help, that I profess to help. If they were being honest, what they would say is, fuck those people that I claim I want to help. I'm only into saying things that make me feel good. That's what I'm here to do. And I will pretend that the things I'm saying are true to continue feeling good. And I will thicken the walls on my reality tunnel to keep people like you out so I can continue to feel good. I think that's one thing that it's happening with people who, you know, maybe haven't looked too closely at these things, certainly not from a research standpoint online. But to hear them coming from professors, is it just that they're so sheltered and they're so not used to having their opinions challenged that they become almost like these intellectual weaklings in certain respects?
Yeah, that's certainly a part of it. Yeah, I mean, that's what I love about Tucker Carlson, especially when he can get academics on, because, you know, this is what they need. I mean, it's good for them, for God's sake. I've been trying to say this to them for a long time. You guys need to get out in the world and argue with people who actually disagree with you, fundamentally disagree with you, not about, you know, here and there around the edges of your ideology, but fundamentally disagree with you. You need to get out there and argue with them, because when they do, mm-hmm. you may have noticed, if you ever watch cable news and they have an academic on, they get destroyed by their intellectual inferiors on Fox News.
Yep. Yep.
Generally speaking, they do. And certainly Tucker Carlson annihilates people.
It's not even just the academics. It's anybody who enjoys that shelter. Watch Bill Nye, the science guy, who isn't even a scientist. You know, just to make a rule for the sheltering effect, right? Bill Nye goes places, he signs autographs, people fawn over him. He tweets something. It gets 20,000 retweets, even if it doesn't make any sense. It makes you lazy. You know, my show, to a certain extent, was a kind of echo chamber before you came along. And that's why people liked having you here, because it made the discourse change. You know, exactly. You could, for a long time, being a libertarian, you could just say things and it was safe. You know,
right.
You could get away with not doing your homework or not thinking things through because you could just state some principle. And I, the more I started to criticize academics, the more I started to observe that in my own circle and in this own safe space that I had created. And I didn't like that. And I felt like a hypocrite. And I don't know if any of them ever have that realization. You go to these people, you say, hey, you know, you should go talk to somebody like who disagrees with you.
Yeah.
Like that's the therapy for the academic. You need to go talk to somebody with a different point of view.
Okay.
What do they say to you?
I don't give a shit about defending libertarians, you know.
Yeah.
You know, there are a whole bunch of them are exactly as you describe and total geeks of the worst sort who, yes, only talk to themselves basically or their best friends.
Mm-hmm.
But however, simply by virtue of being a libertarian in this society now, you are in a minority and you are surrounded all day long by contrary ideas.
Yeah. Sure.
Right? And that's not true for liberals.
Absolutely.
So liberals are surrounded for the most part. And it's very easy for them to totally surround themselves, right, with people saying what they want to hear. It's an issue in my household and has been more of an issue lately since the election because my girlfriend she's as awesome as you can be as a liberal, but she's a liberal in her heart. I mean, she's very open and we've had fantastic conversations and she's very unusual in that way. But it's been hard for her lately, especially. She thought on election night that there were going to be rampaging mobs raping women and attacking Muslims and shooting black people. And I said, you know, I'm not so sure.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was a big fight.
Yeah.
So Ferguson happens in 2014, right? Yes.
Yeah.
Ferguson happens in summer of 2014. I go back and check my Facebook feed then. I was with everybody on that. I remember I posted a photo. In fact, my Facebook cover photo for a few days was a kid in Ferguson throwing a rock or a Molotov cocktail or something at a cop car, I think, something like that. And then after that, the videos start coming out on a pretty regular basis, you know, Eric Garner. And all the shootings, and Walter Scott in South Carolina. And I, for the next year or so, man, did I want to kill some cops.
Yeah.
I wanted to kill some cops. And I thought that there was some serious racism causing this among police officers. And I thought that wasn't the only cause, but I thought that was a principal cause of what I also thought was an epidemic of shootings, of killing unarmed, innocent black men, an epidemic that I assumed had been going on for a very long time. The only difference was that now we had cell phones that could take pictures of it. okay, so now, this is now 2017, everything I just said is not right.
Right.
Yeah. Do I think there are too many killings by police of human beings? Oh, hell yeah. I think the numbers are far, far, far less than I thought then and that most people think now. I think if you're to ask, what do you think, if you're to ask the average person on the street, you know, relatively well-informed, no expert, just someone who reads the New York Times occasionally, whatever, how many unarmed black people are killed by the police in a year? What do you think they would say?
I think they'd give a high number compared to if you followed up with a question about white people. I don't know. I'd say they'd at least think it was one or two a day.
Okay. So last year it was about 35.
Yeah.
And if you look at those, and social scientists have started looking at them, a large number of those, it was pretty clear that the unarmed black person was attacking the police or seriously physically attacking a civilian. Now, I'm really clear here, for abolishing the police.
Yeah.
Okay? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I am no fan of the police, but there is now mounting evidence, and everyone should become acquainted with this guy, this name, Roland Fryer, F-R-Y-E-R. He's an economist either at Harvard or MIT. Again, I hate to do this, but it's done, and I think it is significant. He's a black guy, not just a black guy, but he's a black guy, I believe, from the housing projects in one of the big hoods. I forget which one, in some major city. I forget, but he is, you know, from a black working class family. He's just this wunderkind. He became like a star economist by the time he was 30 years old. Anyway, he did this massive study of the use of police force in Houston as a sample, studied thousands and thousands of cases, ranging from the police just putting their hands on someone to shooting them dead in the street, mm-hmm. thousands, okay? And found that there was actually no difference in the chances of a white person being shot dead than a black person by the Houston police. Houston's a big city, a lot of black people. It's a good place to do a sample. He found that the use of lethal force, there was no evidence of any racial disparities in the use of lethal force. He did find disparities in the use of non-lethal force, like what do you call it, putting hands on people, mm-hmm. not punching them, I don't think, but just, you know, holding them, pushing them, shoving them, etc. The number of black people last year who were killed by police, who were unarmed and posed no threat to the police or any civilians around them, is probably less than 10.
Wow.
So even if you say that all 35 of them or whatever, it's about 35, and it's clear if you just take 1 second and look at the cases, it's clear it's not true. But even if all 35 were unarmed and posed no threat at all, it's 35. That is basically a weekend in Chicago.
Yeah.
Or a week, maybe. The number of white unarmed people killed by police last year in this country was about 95. Now, I understand it's disproportionate. I understand that blacks represent 12% of the population. I get it. But to talk about this as if it is some sort of a Holocaust perpetrated by racist police officers. And by the way, once again, the number of the shootings done by black and Latino police officers.
Yeah.
Let's go further. The majority, clearly, of the black men who were either dead at the hands of a police officer or in a prison right now were killed or put there by police officers who work for a black police commissioner, who are employed by a black or Latino mayor, who are governed by a majority black and Latino city government.
Yeah. Yeah, it's
mass incarceration. I wrote a long review for Reason on this a few months ago. Did a lot of work on it, so everyone should read it. I'm proud of it. It took me a lot. I put a lot into it. But it's very, very clear to me that mass incarceration, the militarization of the police, and police killings in this country have almost nothing to do with race or racism, except that the, of course, basic structural conditions of African Americans now, which is at least a cause of crime, certainly can be traced, at least in part, not entirely, to the history of segregation, Jim Crow, and redlining. Sure. But to focus on cops and their secret racist thoughts, this is the problem. Misses the problem, which is that we have too many laws. We have too many laws governing the smallest, most private, insignificant details of our lives that forces, those laws force police officers to go places where they shouldn't go, to arrest people they shouldn't arrest, like Eric Garner.
Right.
Like Walter Scott, who ran out of his car. No one knows this. Do you know why Walter Scott ran out of his car? The guy who was shot in the back?
No.
He ran out of his car because he was late on child support payments.
Yeah.
To his ex-wife. And he was afraid he would get busted for that. Another vast universe of laws and a whole system that is totally stacked against men that we need to talk about that is causing a lot of this police violence, because the police are forced to go enforce these laws.
Right.
So what the left does, and what most people do now, not just the left, whenever one of these things happens, is they need to talk about that evil racist cop who killed so-and-so.
Yeah, and it pushes us further and further into a kind of progressive hell. You know, even just talking about a guy getting shot in the back for being late on child support payments, right? I mean, that's what you're describing.
Yeah. The Walter Scott thing, here is where I'm going to freak everybody right out, okay? When I saw that video, I was like, oh, there's as clear-cut a case of, you name it, racist, needless, sadistic murder by a cop. No, he shot the guy. He was running away from the cop, and he got shot in the back as he's running away from the cop, right? How could that be anything other than a terrible and likely racist shooting?
Right.
Well, guess what? So a kid, graduate student in Minnesota, there's a documentary about this, took it upon himself. He became interested in this for some strange reason and watched and took the video and studied it frame by frame by frame. And he found that it is quite likely that that police officer was doing what he was supposed to do according to South Carolina law, federal law, and the code of conduct of the police nationally, which is, if you look at that video, it's not guaranteed, but it is quite possible that he believed that Walter Scott still had his taser. Scott did pull the taser out of the cop's holster and did run and started to run away. What happened was he pulled the taser out and then dropped it and then ran away. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the video, it is quite plausible, the way the cop's head is positioned, that he did not ever notice, didn't see that the taser was dropped, and believed that Scott was holding the taser in his hand while he was running away from him. Okay, according to law and policy, a police officer is obligated to use lethal force to stop anyone who has taken their weapon, including a taser. So what killed Walter Scott? Should we talk about the racism of whatever that cop's name is? Or should we talk about the family law and divorce law system in this country, which caused him to run out of his car? And we should talk about the use of force rules for police officers.
Right.
And we should also talk about the fact that they carry weapons. That's what killed Walter Scott. And that's what we should be talking about. When I raise these things with professors, and I've had arguments with professors online about this, it is, not only is it, am I naive and that guy is just a racist and we should string him up, But of course, I am aiding and abetting a racist system. My point is, you could have, if we found a drug that eliminated all racist thoughts, and we forced all police officers in this country to take that drug and made them completely physically non-racist, they would still be killing a whole lot of black people.
Yeah.
And putting them in prison. So I'm done.
Yeah, I just, while you were talking about that, I was thinking, from my experience being on the left and being a libertarian, sure, the discovery of each ideology gave me initially a kind of moral superiority that I didn't earn, right?
Yeah.
In both cases. It's a hard thing to let go of because it's so exciting when you first get it, and it's so powerful, you know, especially after, you know, being in college and feeling so small most of your life, to suddenly have something to fight against, you know, to have some kind of, well, I think it's just a natural impulse of growing up, right? There's evil that you want to fight, and then you get it. You find out what it is because your professors will tell you. And it was an easy transition for me into the philosophy of liberty, but it was the same kind of shallow motivations that initially took me there, right? I could be the moral superior of every argument. So as much hostility as I have towards the left, I have enough experience with that I still understand it's a very hard thing to let go of. And if people do what you've just described over the last 15 minutes to really dig into the story and not just apply an ideology to the story, it creates a lot of discomfort. And a lot of people don't want to do that. And I see a lot of people in my circles who don't want to do that. Libertarianism is actually kind of like this battle for a battle between moral superiority and edginess. You know, and you have like the people who are going more of the way of the Trump and the alt-right, their impulse is the edginess. And I think the people who are going more, and this is a crude generalization, but I'm just telling you the things that I pick up, the subtleties, sure, the micro expressions, the tones of voice, the people who are drawn more to the left are those who embrace more of the moral superiority and sense of enlightenment, you know? So there's an interesting subtext to this, but yeah, as you're telling that story, I'm just applying that to many different types of conversations about things like, you know, racial issues, generally cultural issues, and coming to these difficult loggerheads with people and trying to understand what it's really about and why some people don't really want to dig into the numbers or the details of these things. It's like they're satisfied with the answers they've already arrived at, and questioning those things is kind of a threat, and that's challenging.
Yeah. Coda to my Walter Scott thing about and race and criminal justice, just, you know, in the Reason piece that I wrote recently, you know, I did this research. Doesn't take anyone long to do this. And it was amazing to me. No one had done this. It's all over the place. It's easy to find. There are, as we speak right now, about 500,000 white people in state and federal prisons, mm-hmm, in this country, about 500,000 people. That's state and federal. That's not counting local jails.
Right.
Okay. Half a million. Okay. So the rate of whites incarcerated in the United States is higher than the overall incarceration rates of all but 8 other countries on earth. Mm-hmm. So we are incarcerating white people at a faster rate than Russia is, than China is, than Iran is, than Rwanda is. It's mass incarceration is a Holocaust that has been visited upon white people too.
Yeah.
And until we address that and understand that and stop closing our eyes to it, because no one even knows that. That is news to people. People have no idea. If you were to ask most people who's in prison now, it's going to be a black guy. It's all black. Now, it's so totally true that blacks, of course, are disproportionately incarcerated. No doubt about that. But to suggest that it's a racist conspiracy, which is really, that's the argument, by the way, made by Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow, famous book, this horrendous documentary done by Ava DuVernay called The 13th, on Netflix, especially The 13th. That's a crime, because what she's doing is making it more and more difficult. What all this discourse is doing is making it more and more difficult to actually end mass incarceration. Mm-hmm. When you moralize, when you try to seek the secret evil thoughts of people rather than look at policies, you miss what can solve the problems. You miss what can end the policies. If it was a racist plot, which is what the 13th argues, why on earth did they put millions of white people in prison to do that? I mean, it just makes no sense. But if you read the history, which is what I did in writing this piece for Reason, you can see all the policies, which began, by the way, with the progressives at the turn of the 20th century. They're the ones who first prohibited drugs, mm-hmm. the Food and Drug Act, 1906. They're the ones who established the Federal Bureau of Investigation. That's Teddy Roosevelt and progressives in his Justice Department. They're the ones who nationalized the police force. They're the ones who had prohibition, mm-hmm. right? Which created a huge black market, which created all this violence. They're the ones in the 1960s and 1970s who further nationalized the police force and started putting millions and millions of federal dollars into police forces to enhance surveillance, to give them military equipment, to train them in military techniques. This all came from the feds. These were all progressive ideas that Lyndon Johnson implemented full force in the 1960s. Nixon, who was a progressive, people don't understand this, but he was very much a progressive. In fact, he was to the left of most progressives on welfare, et cetera. He took it another step further, more militarization, more centralization, a ramping up of the war on drugs and the war on crime. Those are progressive programs. Those are progressive ideas that were not racist. They were intended to maintain social control over a restive population, which originally was immigrants. They weren't so concerned about blacks. And in fact, black neighborhoods until the 1960s were largely unpoliced. Mm-hmm. And what happened was in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, black activists in those neighborhoods said, hey, it's racist not to give us security. Bring the cops in here. We have all these drug dealers and addicts and gangsters ruining our lives, and there's no police protecting us. Black clergy, black activists, black political leaders, black Democratic political leaders, black Congress people, Charles Rangel, the Congressional Black Caucus in the 1960s and 70s, all across the board there unanimously said, we want more cops, we want longer prison sentences, we want mandatory minimum sentences, we want life terms for drug dealers. These were black people in Harlem, in Philly, mm-hmm. in Southside Chicago, demanding this shit and saying it's racist for you not to give us that. So if you read Michelle Alexander's book, if you watch the 13th, guess what is not mentioned? That this was a demand of, now I'm not on the side of those black leaders who were calling for that.
Absolutely.
But the shit ain't racist, people. It's not racist. Now, does that mean there was no one in the Nixon administration who was, of course not, there were racists? Does this mean there was no Republican who had racist thoughts when he voted for the crime bill, blah, blah, blah? Of course. Got to do this. You have 5 minutes?
Yeah, go ahead. And I want to ask you a question after that, and I want to make sure I don't forget it.
Got to do this.
Go ahead.
Libertarians hate nothing more than the drug war. So your audience should appreciate this. Most scholars agree that the principal driver of mass incarceration in the last 40 years has been the mandatory minimum laws in various states, enacted in various states. Okay. What was the first mandatory minimum law? Very notorious Rockefeller drug laws of 1973 in New York State, mm-hmm. which gave just unbelievable, like 25 to life year sentences for possession, not just selling, possession of marijuana and cocaine.
Right.
Nelson Rockefeller was a Republican, but he was known as a Rockefeller Republican, which meant progressive Republican.
Yep. Yep.
Pro-New Deal, pro-choice, pro-EPA, you name it, pro-Medicaid, pro-Medicare. He was way more progressive than Hillary Clinton ever would be. Mm-hmm. The second bill, then I'm done, these were the first two mandatory minimum sentence bills, laws in the states that got the whole ball rolling. Was in Michigan. Year later, forget the guy's name, the governor's name, he was a Nelson Rockefeller Republican, super progressive. He loved this because what progressives hate more than anything is people getting high. because then they can't work. So we have to give them the most medieval punishments to teach them a lesson that instead of getting high, they have to be productive citizens.
Well, that changed. That doesn't seem to be what the order is anymore.
What do you mean?
It doesn't seem like most progressives care, like by today's standards, whether people work or not. Working people will pay for them not to work.
Oh, well, that's a whole other show.
Okay. But go ahead. Yeah.
I mean, no. Well, okay. Yeah, that's a longer discourse. Sorry, I got wound up there, but that's been eating me for a while now. Because again, since the election, it's nothing but this just obsession with racism as the cause of everything bad.
Well, what it does too is it takes people out of a frame of mind where they can reason through important issues. And puts them, you know, if they're like a majority of people and they're white and they're like a majority of people having political conversations and they're male, it puts them into defensive positions. It puts people into very emotional positions because these identity issues are very emotional and divisive almost by design, it seems to me.
Sure.
You know,
yeah.
Like my last show, Thad, was on Andrew Breitbart, Rethinking Andrew Breitbart. And
oh, wow.
If you go back and you listen to him 5 years ago, the shit he was warning people about while being called a racist and being dismissed. And I mean, Breitbart 5 years ago is not Breitbart.com today. And
right.
He was on top of all of this stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he said, they're trying to divide us. They're trying to divide us. That's all they're trying to do. And, you know, he gave so many speeches about this. You know, it's absolutely true. It's almost like there's this design to prevent discourse. And obviously this spills into the academic circle as well. And this is what, you know, Peterson has been warning about in Canada. But what I wanted to ask you, when you're talking about, guess what they didn't mention, when they're calling all of these police practices and criminal justice practice racist, is that a kind of conscious and deliberate occulting of that information, or is it just ignorance that they're not mentioning the history of these things? Is it just a convenience to ignore the history so you can call them racist?
Oh, well,
or is it
ignorance? Michelle
Alexander,
I don't know if you're aware of this book, but it kind of really got the ball rolling on the mass incarceration stuff a few years ago. It's called The New Jim Crow. I mean, she's became a big celebrity because of this, and sort of put mass incarceration as a term in popular discourse. She obviously ignores it. I mean, it's, you know, it's, or she downplays it. There's, I think, like a half a paragraph on black support for drug laws, and she sort of dismisses it as unimportant. The book that I reviewed for Reason for this piece is really egregious in how it does that, how it treats it. It ignores, I think, entirely. Yeah, she doesn't even mention. Yeah, she doesn't even mention the 400 or 500 page history of mass incarceration. All these policies written by a Harvard professor of history, doesn't mention once black support for drug laws and the war on crime, doesn't mention a whole lot of stuff. And of course, those people know what's out there. I mean, of course, they, you know, they overlook it. I mean, because I don't know what goes on in their mind. I mean, I have to suspect that they have to have some guilty feelings about it. But really, just I want to say this thing about, because you raised a really important question, which I think is at the heart of all of this, which is moralism.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about how the left tends to be moralistic and that libertarians tend to be more edgy. Yeah, I would say more than anything else, that's the reason I abandoned the left, was their moralism. I really hated it. It is bad for a number of reasons. And the one I've been pointing to today is that it actually causes us to miss what is the source of the evils we all agree are evils. You know, we agree with the left, I hope, on mass incarceration and prisons and cops killing people. Cops do kill way too many people. I just don't think it's because of racism. I also don't think they kill as many people as we think, but I don't give a shit. One person is way too many for me. So we agree on that, and I want to end it. Like, I want to end it. I want every single nonviolent offender in prison right now released tonight, immediately, and maybe even give them reparations for it.
Well, you care about that on principle. That's so. I wouldn't maybe like make that comparison to the left. They care about it because of political expedience. If you prove to them beyond a reasonable doubt that, oh, none of this has anything to do with racism or oppression, I guarantee that it wouldn't be overnight, but in a week, none of them would care about any of that anymore. And in fact, I'm starting to believe, and you can call me a cynic, that if it suited their purposes, they would do 180s on their attitudes about mass incarceration. You know, if it meant stopping some kind of alt-right uprising, I think they'd be for it.
You know, so a lot of them would be using words like design, and it sounded like you were describing a conspiracy, that Breitbart at least was describing a conspiracy, a concerted, deliberate, conscious effort to divide people. I don't think that's true. I think, again, it's religious thinking. I think it's religion. And I think that the academic left, and I say academic left because I don't include, you know, the physicists and the chemists and the, maybe even some of the people in anthropology, but, you know, most historians, all sociologists, pretty much half of political scientists practice religious thinking and are in a seminary. It's a seminary. They're priests and training other priests. And again, so they see evil. And so there's no point, as this woman from Princeton said to Tucker Carlson, there's no point in studying evil. That's actually what she said. There's no point in studying evil. Guys, hello. And by the way, this was the argument made to justify the invasion of Iraq, which was that they're evil. And so what, you're going to study the cause of terrorism? No. Hello. You don't study the devil. You just destroy the devil. And it's the echo chamber, both. So it's they think there's evil and they have no one who disagrees with them. I don't think they're sitting there plotting to destroy those who disagree with them. I think that they just see those who disagree with them as people who must be vanquished.
I do think that it could even be a kind of widespread subconscious project, right? Like, division serves my interests. Division makes me relevant. If division goes away, you know, whether I'm in the media or I'm an intellectual or I'm an academic promoting these ideas, I lose my purpose. I said that in a snarky moment to somebody I was debating online. I shouldn't have said it. I'm sorry. But just to kind of sum up the idea, I said, if this problem went away today, then you'd have to go out and find something else to be outraged about, like immediately. Like, you are just tears in search of something to shed them on. You know, you should be happy this problem exists. And all right, you call me on something, though, that's important. And we can end with this as kind of a, you know, we can talk about this next time. As a storyteller, after doing this show for 7 years, my impulse, and it's an impulse that I have to kind of control, is to always seek the most malevolence, right, in trying to understand something. Like, there's a plot. So, like, when I discovered that there was this thing called the Frankfurt School, which we could talk about a little bit next time, and I found out there was a possibility that they might have been funded by the KGB, I said, holy shit, how exciting. So my story was, I went to college, I encountered Howard Zinn and lefty professors who said, you've been lied to your whole life. They all lied to you. They all lied to you. And they kept the truth from you as if it was a conspiracy. And then before I discovered libertarianism, I actually discovered it by accident when I became a conspiracy theorist, a 9/11 truther, and Alex Jones. It's all bullshit, man. You've been lied to. They all lied to you, right? So I got a lot of almost behaviorist positive reinforcement from thinking that I had discovered these things. You know, I had uncovered a plot against me and people that I could protect from the plot. So I do have a tendency to use that language, right? Whether and part of the reason why I want to have a conversation with somebody like you who has this totally different perspective is I know that you can fill in my blind spots, and you and other people can help me fill in my blind spots. And ultimately, I can, you know, take that advice that you gave me at the beginning of this conversation, like, calm down, calm down a little bit.
Let me finish by throwing a huge curveball.
Yeah.
Which is that, what have I been doing in the last 30 or 40 minutes? Getting quite emotional and feeling quite superior to a whole lot of people and feeling pleasure in the anger. Mm-hmm. There was certainly some pleasure. I mean, you know, I also was on the verge of crying too, but like, I, you know, there's some anger there and that's pleasurable, right? Gee, what does that sound like? Right. It's this, it's the moral superiority. It's the outrage. It's the it's the righteous indignation, et cetera. It's what you're describing that goes on among the leftists, you know, and again, I do it. I'm not blaming anybody, but yeah, we have to be careful. There are leftists and there are leftists, and there are leftists I really do respect. So here's again, what I think everyone, including myself, you know, it's funny. I got really really emotional about immigration and deportations. I mean, I have been generally since the election, which is odd, right? Because I shouldn't be. I should be just as emotional as before. But it just really started hitting me, being living in LA, especially, you know, because you're just around immigrants all the time. Your whole life is sort of immigrants everywhere.
Yeah.
And I got really, really emotional one night. And I thought to myself about this family that I saw cleaning my gym. And I thought, you know, after I let that go, I said, wait a minute. What? You don't even know who they are.
Yeah.
You don't know anything about them except that they're most likely undocumented people, probably from Mexico. Mm-hmm. What is that? Like, I don't actually believe in empathy. And I don't think I should even be celebrated or applauded or anyone should think anything positive about me getting emotional about that. I think it actually might be dangerous. That's what I actually like about libertarians generally, is that they, sometimes it scares me, but I do think it's a healthier way to deal with politics. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking about dealing with your interpersonal relationships. I mean, I'm talking about politics, which means when you're talking about power and contests over power, and especially when it means that you're talking about people you don't know and never will know. They're just abstractions, or they're just the Mexican family you don't even know the name of, right? And that's what the left traffics in. Like the emotion I felt just now.
Yeah.
That's their currency. That's what drives them. And I don't know exactly what that is, actually. I'm actually skeptical of it. I mean, part of me wants to say, gee, Thad, you're such a great person for being so, so sad and so unhappy, so upset about the poor Mexican people. But, you know, do I know that they're unhappy? Do I know that they're, I don't know anything. They didn't come to me and say, Mister, will you please save us from the evil Donald Trump? No, they were actually happy and running around my gym and the kids were playing and having a great time. I don't know anything about them, but I just jumped to this conclusion that they're victims.
And it wasn't a choice.
What's that?
It wasn't a choice that you got to have that feeling come over you. And I think that's part of its power.
Well, right? I do have a choice.
You think so?
Oh yeah. Because I used to have those feelings much more than I do now.
Yeah.
And at first I thought, oh shit, am I just becoming a bad person? And I think now I'm glad, because what it means is I'm able to look at the issue rationally, figure out, first of all, whether I want to change anything about it.
Yeah.
Whether it serves my interests, which it should, right?
Yeah.
Should be interested in myself instead of, or am I just being a goddamn savior? It's a savior impulse that's in me still. You know, I was raised by lefties in Berkeley. You know, it's still in me, I think. And doesn't mean I'm still open borders, you know, but again, if you just let the emotions take over, in particular those emotions which are about pity.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think it's pity, because there's no way I can identify with them. That's the other thing. Like, I can't identify with them in any way whatsoever. I have never been an immigrant. I have never been a Mexican. I have never been poor in LA. I've never been none of that. There's nothing. I have no way to relate to that at all.
And you don't know enough about them to even have grounds for relating, really.
Right.
Yeah,
exactly. So I think my recommendation is whenever anyone feels overcome by emotion like I just was, after it's gone, instead of feeling good that you felt bad for those poor people or whatever it was, stop and look at yourself and think about, where did that come from? What was that really about? I think what it was really about was something about me. I don't know what it was, but I think it was about me, something about me. It wasn't about them at all. And so then what happens is, if you start to see, right, if I then start to prescribe, you know, policies, laws, how other people should behave, changes in the culture, right?
Based on how you felt.
Yeah, it's about something about me. It's not even serving the people I claim to be serving. It is probably driven by some savior complex that places me, and this is the thing, the savior complex places the person in a superior position.
Mm-hmm.
I can save, I must save them. I can save them and I must save them. That Mexican family never fucking asked me to save them. If I came up to them and said, oh, can I help you? I mean, how patronizing would that be, right? If someone asked me to help them, that's a different thing. But you, what you're doing is you're assuming your own superiority. This is what people don't understand on the left. They do this all the time.
Yeah, well, absolutely. God, if we could bottle what happened in the last 15 minutes here, because for most people, that rush of serotonin that they get from that experience of feeling like that savior, there is no reason, there is no facts that they are going to let interfere with that meaning and that purpose they get from that. Because, you know, I honestly think that part of it is these kids are at a point, like young people, so the people who seem so passionate and so vocal about this stuff, they're at a time in their life where they are almost biologically, John Haidt has talked about this, they're almost biologically primed to explore and rebel. And if you can point them at something and they can get that satisfaction from doing it, they might never come back from that. They might never rethink that.
So I mean, I'm not a big fan of height or biological determinism, and I'm skeptical of these claims about even teenagers, and because, you know, I don't think that 18-year-olds and 19-year-olds who aren't in elite colleges are doing that stuff. You know what I mean?
I agree. Yeah, they don't have time.
I mean, and I mean, and by the way, only elite colleges. You know, I don't know. I don't think 19-year-olds down the street at Chemeketa Community College here are doing that shit. They're studying to work at Wells Fargo Bank. You know. No, I think what goes on, and I'm speculating, okay, but having been a college student in very much that position, I feel like I have some knowledge here. I think it is it's a rebellion against the absent parents. So the
freedom, part of the freedom,
often, what's that?
Having that freedom finally, like a kind of a rebellion after the fact almost.
But you no longer have your mom and dad to beat up on. So what you have, though, is the college president, who invariably is evil, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what we thought. Everybody thinks the college president, because that's the nearest parental figure. So he must have done something bad.
That was the case for you, right?
I think that's really what's driving much of this. It's the people on campus, parental figures, and then maybe some surrogates in the outer world, like the president of the United States, but whatever. I think most of their fire is directed at the people on campus, actually, administrators.
I think it's dispersed, right? I know you told a story about, like, when you were in college, somebody shit on the president's desk, right?
Yeah.
And Christina Hoff Sommers, when I interviewed her, she had really similar stories. Today, that targeting of evil, because there's so much more. Where were you going to learn about evil in, you know, or even me, you know, 20 years ago? Like, the world was so closed off to us. There's so much evil to target today. It's everywhere. So I feel like it's more dispersed. But yeah, I think you're right. It, basically, what you're saying is that the president becomes the new father figure, and he gets it first. And
the father who's failing you.
Yeah, exactly.
He's not doing enough for you. And whatever your problems are in life, he probably has at least something to do with it. He's probably responsible for it because he wasn't a good enough father. So that's what we think about our own fathers, right? And now you're here, you're 18, you're 19, you're out of the home for the first time, and you got no dad around anymore at all. And so that rage is still there, and you might even feel a little abandoned. And lo and behold, there's this kind of imperious kind of dick in a suit up on the hill in that big office building who lords it over us all. Oh, he's the target now. I really think that's what's going on. It's adolescent rebellion directed at the college administrators.
Okay, last part of that, because I think how I said this was very multifaceted, like lots of streams come together to produce the current situation. It almost seemed like that would have been the case for you, right, in the 80s and 90s, and for me in the late 90s. But today, it almost seems like that figure has a larger role than just something that you rebel against, because we didn't get – you had parents, from the stories I've heard you tell about them, even though they had very strong political views, they didn't try to impose them on you. My parents didn't either. My parents didn't helicopter around me, because no one had ever heard of doing that then. That was – you'd look like a maniac doing that with your kids. But that became the norm in the generation after mine. you know? Yeah. So now it's almost like that authority, that paternalism and maternalism is just something that when they go to college, they don't know how to do without it. Like, we wanted the freedom. That was so invigorating and exciting to be like, we can drink every night. We can throw bottles in the parking lot. Like, it was like a high schooler's dream, you know? Today, so we rebelled against that, but today it's almost like these kids, to a certain extent, they need that. And it's not just the administrators or the presidents, it's the professors. And I think because of that, it's more dangerous than it's ever been before. And if you want to like leave it there, we could pick that up in a future conversation.
Sure. Anything you want, man.
All right.
I'm yours. Well, man, that was intense.
I think that was the best conversation we've had.
Not saying something. Gotta get up, I gotta get up, boom. Gotta get up, I gotta get up, boom. Gotta get up, I gotta get up, boom. Na 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 na. Gotta get up, I gotta get up, boom. Gotta get up, I gotta get up, boom. Gotta get up, I gotta get up, boom. Na 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 na. Shoulders, knees, toes, look alive. It's time to go. Head, shoulders, knees, toes, look alive. It's time to go. Head, shoulders, knees, toes, look alive. It's time to go. Head, shoulders, knees, toes, look alive. It's time to go.